Morning.
I wanted
to look today something, I guess, a little different. I'm very excited about today's shiur. Not that I'm not always excited, but particularly excited today. I learned a lot of things in passing as I tried to answer some questions. Parshas B'Shalach is one of, I'll get to where we are in a second. Parshas B'Shalach is one of the most difficult parshas in the Torah to understand, I believe. There are so many ups and downs for Bnei Yisrael. They're going out of Mitzrayim, big positive, Kriyas Yamsuf, and then they begin complaining that there's no water. So then God sends a miracle, and then there's sweet water. Then they complain again, so then they have no food. Why are you trying to kill us here? And then they have man, and they complain again, then they get the quail, and then they're complaining some more, and then Amalek comes because they're complaining so much. And then in the end, Moshe lifts his hands up in the air, and they're all looking towards Shemayim, and they defeat Amalek for now. And it just, what's going through the minds of Bnei Yisrael is very, very difficult to understand. But that's not what we're going to look at today. But I wanted to at least recognize that point because it's very important. Maybe we might be able to touch on it a little bit, but I think it's very important. But I do want to focus on something else. We know that generally, I mean, always, there's a connection between the Parsha and the Haftorah. The Haftorah for Parsha B'Shalach, which is where we're going to be, it's on page 1,152, I believe, is the 1,152 in the back of the article. I believe it is the longest Haftorah that we ever have. You see, it's page 1,100, so you can come late to shul on Shabbos. 1,152, 1,153, and 1,154. Three whole pages. But it's only for Ashkenazim.
Right.
The Sfardim knock off half the Haftorah. They begin from Perek Hei. Now, what's the Haftorah? The Haftorah is the famous Shira of Devorah. Devorah the Nevi'ah.
Yes.
She has her song, and that's what the Haftorah is about. So, seemingly, the obvious connection between the Haftorah and between the Parsha is that in the Parsha, we have Shira Sayam, we have Az Yashir. So, we find the Haftorah, which has a beautiful Shira, also the Shira of Devorah, and we link the two together. Now, if that's all the Haftorah was about, then the Sfardim are 100% right, and we should save ourselves a lot of time in Shul, because we should start from the beginning of Perek Hei, in the middle of page 1,153. They began singing, and they sang their song, and we have more than enough. We have 31 psukim beyond the 21 that we normally have for a Haftorah. And we wouldn't have added on almost all of Perek Dalet, which is another 20 psukim. So it seemed to be obvious to me, at least, that there has to be something more to the connection between the Parsha and the Haftorah, in that we attach an extra 20 psukim that seemingly there's no reason to. We don't need to do it just to have enough psukim for the Haftorah. It would have been enough to have the Shiras Devorah. Now, the story which is in Perek Dalet is something which has come up a few times, which is one of the reasons that I was excited to be able to learn. It is the story of Yael. We discussed the story of Yael a little bit when we were talking about Yehudis when it came to Hanukkah, and there were, I guess, a lot of issues that come up in the story. And in particular, since I have a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, that I like to point out the things that we were taught in only one dimension in school, and they left out a lot of the picture. I enjoy looking at those things. So the story of Yael and Sisera certainly provides another application. At least in my mind, I was very, very shocked by some of the things that I learned in looking at this story. So that's what I wanted to do today. So we are going to zero in a little bit on the Parsha, but more towards the end. But I think, it's clear to me that there has to be more of a connection to the Parsha than just the fact that the Parsha has Az Yashir, which is the Shira, and the Haftorah has the Shira of Devorah, because we attach this extra 20 psukim at the beginning. In fact, I did find, somebody pointed out that there's an old minhag of some of the Italians who begin the Haftorah like the Ashkenazim, and they only include a little bit of the beginning of the Shira of Devorah. They don't even do the entire Shira of Devorah, which certainly would support this theory, at least according to them, that the main focus is really on Perek Dalet, is really on the story of the battle against Sisera, and the Shira of Devorah is a little bit more of an afterthought. Okay, once we have a shira in the parsha, so certainly we should have a, we should take the shira, which is appropriate from the, which is following, and attach it here as well. Okay. Good. So let's look at the story of Sisera and Yael as it appears in the psukim. So, it's very long. So I don't know if we're going to do the, start with the entire thing. We'll try to do the parts maybe that are more related. But we basically have Devorah is the Nevi'ah. She's the prophetess at the time. Whether exactly she was a shofet, shofetess, or similar role to a shofet is a, is an interesting discussion. It does say he shofetess. So she certainly was the one in charge. And she, together with Barak ben Avinoam, were fighting against the against Sisera. Now Sisera was not the king. Sisera was the general of the army of Yavin Melech Chatzor. So those are, I guess, the characters here. And fine. So basically speaking, a nace happens, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes it rain, and Sisera's chariots and his army's chariots get stuck in the mud, and the army is basically wiped out. So if we pick up at Pimperek Dalet Pasuk Tesvav near the bottom on page 1152, it says, Vayoas Hashem es Sisera v'skol recha v'skol machana v'yicherev lifnei Barak, and they were all basically wiped out. Vayered Sisera me'al ha'merkava, and Sisera got off of his chariot, vayonas biraglov, and he runs away. Uvarak radap acharei ha'recha v'acharei ha'machaneh, so Barak is running after them, ad charoshes ha'goyim, to this, this place, this camp of charoshes ha'goyim, vayipoko machaneh Sisera v'yicherev, and the entire camp of Sisera is destroyed, lo nishar ad echad, not a single one was left, except for Sisera. V'sisera nas biraglov, and Sisera ran on his feet, El Ohel Yael Eishes Chever Hakeni. And Sisera runs. What's his destination? It tells us what's his destination. Where is he going? He's running to get to the tent of Yael. Who is she? She's the wife of Chever Hakeni. You have to figure out who Chever Hakeni is also. Why is she running to the tent of Yael? The Navi tells us, Ki Shalom Ben Yavin Melech Hatzor Ben Bis Chever Hakeni. It was some sort of peace, whether it was a formal treaty, whether it was good relations, whether it was some sort of alliance. There was a good relationship between Yavin Melech Hatzor, that's the king for whom Sisera is fighting. Sisera is the general of Yavin Melech Hatzor's army. And between the house of Chever Hakeni. Chever Hakeni is the husband of Yael. So this seems like a perfect place for Sisera to run to escape from the battle. But they say Yael likras Sisera, and it seems to be that Yael sees Sisera coming, and so she goes out and she greets Sisera. Vatomer Elav, and she says to him, Sura Adoni, Sura Eli Al Tira, come to me, my master, come, don't be afraid. Vayasar Eleha Oala Batechaseo Basmicha, and she, he goes into her tent, she covers him up with a blanket. Vayomer Elav, he says to her, Hashtini Nom Atmayim Kitsomesi, give me a little bit of water to drink, because I'm thirsty. So she opens up a skin of milk and gives him to drink from that and covers him up again. So Sisera says to Yael, Amod Pesach Ha'ol, stand by the entrance of the tent. If anybody should come, Ushelech, and is going to start asking you, Amar Hayesh Po'ish, is there anybody here? Are you harboring anybody? So you'll say no. Vatikach Yael Eishes Chever, and Yael, the wife of Chever, takes Es Yisad HaOhel. She takes the peg of the tent. Vatasa Mes HaMakeves Biyoda, and she also takes the hammer that apparently was used to knock in these pegs into the tent. Vatavo Eilav Balat, and she comes very carefully, stealthily, the art scroll says. Vatiskas HaYosei Birakoso, and she drives the peg into his temple, but it's not ba'aretz until it goes through to the into the ground. V'hu nirdam v'yo'af v'yamos, and he was knocked unconscious, and he died. V'nei Barak rodepes Sisera v'teitze Yael l'krasos. So Barak is running after Sisera. So Yael comes out to greet Barak Vatomer Lo Leich Vareko Esuisha Sharatam Vakesh. I'll show you the person you're looking for. I'll show you where Sisera is. Vayavo Ela, and he came, Vine Sisera Nofomes Vayosid Birako So. And he goes and he discovers that he's dead and he has this peg through his head. Okay. Seems like a very straightforward story. Okay, she definitely had a lot of courage. She definitely had a lot of courage. It seems to be...
The peg must symbolize something because it's just so...
So before we get to...
It's told, it's very really like... It's just weird. That she took the peg before he fell asleep, but then it only says he was sleeping after.
I think that means that he was like knocked unconscious more than fell asleep. It seems to be that...
There was something in the water.
The milk. That's our milk from last time.
Right.
The milk which might not have happened last time did happen this time.
Right.
So by Yehudas we weren't sure if there was really milk, but this time the Navi does say that there was milk. So again, we need to try to understand a few things. So again, Sisera seems to be looking specifically to go to the tent of Yael. Why? Why? The Navi told us why. Right? There's peace. Why exactly is there peace between the house of Chever Akeni and between Yavin Melech Hatzor? Who are these people that they're making their own peace treaties? And then why did she use the tent peg and a hammer? Why not pick up a sword? Okay, so one possibility is that's what she had.
That's right.
She didn't have a sword there, she only had a weapon. The Kli Yakar says something very interesting. That she knew that what she was doing was very dangerous. Right? She was putting her life on the line. What happens if as she's coming up to drive this peg into Sisera's head, Sisera wakes up. He's this presumably huge general, and she's some little woman. And what's gonna happen? So she figured that one way of possibly saving herself if he wakes up at the last second is if she has a sword in her hand, she has no chance. Mm-hmm. It's clear that she's coming to kill him. If she's holding the peg of the tent and the hammer, so then she can quickly try to say, oh, I'm going over there to fix and to knock another, to drive another peg into the corner of the tent, and she can try to get away with it. Presumably, again, especially, which is a point we have to try to understand, especially if there's peace between Yavin Melech Hatzor and between Beis Chever Akeni, so Sisera really thinks that everything's going to be okay. So he's not suspecting Yael of doing anything, which is something we'll have to understand also, which is that is it a little bit inappropriate what she's doing, and she's taking advantage of the fact that there was this treaty between, on a moral level, she's taking advantage of the fact that there was a treaty and there's peace between her family and between Yavin Melech Hatzor, and she's using that in order to get to Sisera. Chazal have a little bit of an added perspective on the peg that we'll get to a little bit later.
Because she could use the hammer alone, and she could say the same thing. So why the peg is it very important?
Well, I think you have a better chance of making sure he's dead with the peg than through his head than just the hammer, but I don't know.
She could miss and hit her thumb.
It's true. Okay. But what seems to be, I don't know, funny is just that it seems to be a very straightforward story. There's nothing questionable. There's nothing inappropriate. Everything seems to be laid out very, very clearly by the Navi as to what happens. It doesn't seem to be a controversial story at all. So why was Sisera running towards the tent of Yael? So we said because of the peace. I always thought that he was running to her tent because as he's running away, not necessarily with that destination, although the Pesukim seem to tell us otherwise, Yael comes out and she convinces him and seduces him and tells him to come inside, and then he falls prey to her, and then the entire story unfolds. But the Navi doesn't say that. It doesn't say that in the Pesukim. It does say that he sought refuge there, again, because there is peace. So the Radak points out that one of the reasons, again, besides the reason that the Navi gives of there being peace between the family of Chever Hakeni and between Sisera, another reason that he went specifically to her tent was because if Barak was pursuing Sisera, Sisera assumed that he would never start searching inside a woman's tent. again, as long as he would go up to the tent and he would ask her, but it wouldn't be Derech Eretz for Barak to start looking around inside of her tent. In a certain sense, it's similar to the story of On Ben Pelet's wife, who was keeping guard outside and made sure to keep the men away, and that way she could protect her husband inside. So he had a similar type of theory. Sisera was thinking, if I'm in, again, we're talking about within the Jews, so if Barak is doing this, he's not going to act inappropriately. So that would be another way of protecting him. So again, the basic idea was that we needed to have the peace, but why didn't he go to Chevra Keni's tent? Why did he go specifically to his wife's tent? So that the Mefarshim say is because that would be a better hiding place. And again, the Malbim asks the questions, Eich asis ayal kadaver hara hazeh, how could she do such a terrible thing? Laharoga sisra achar sheshalom beino vein beis balo balabesa. He's coming to her house to seek refuge because of this peace treaty, and she goes against everything. It says, v'zen neged chukei hamedinos. He said, there are rules, whether it's, you know, Geneva Conventions or unofficial rules. But again, if there are peace treaties, they are to be respected. So how could she have violated them? So he does offer a few approaches that maybe it doesn't apply to the wife. It only applies to the man of Chevra Keni. He couldn't include it. There's some technical answers to try to get out of it. But again, in terms of the basic story, what happened to the story that we were always told? It doesn't seem to exist in the Navi. And the truth is that the opinion of Reish Lakish that's recorded in the Medrash is basically in line with what the Navi says here, and nothing inappropriate happened. And he says, Shloshahim Shebarchu min Havera Veshatav HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shemo Imahem. There were three people who had the potential to be involved in an Avera and weren't, and therefore God put his name amongst them. Who are the three people? Elohim Yosef. Okay, that's the obvious one, the classic one, that Yosef saved and avoided sinning with the wife of Potiphar. And he says that's the pasuk of Edus B'Yosef, that the pasuk in Tehillim, when it's referring to Yosef, it adds the hey in, it's God putting his name into Yosef's, and showing that Yosef didn't sin. V'Yael, Yael is the second one, and the last one was Palti, not to get too involved, but the story, basic story of Palti bin Laish was that Shaul gave his daughter Michal to Palti bin Laish as a wife after she was already married to David. And the Gemara tells that he basically took a sword and put it between them in the beds and said that if either of us touch each other, then this sword should kill us. Then she was already married to, David, and the Torah is made on that relationship as well. And finally, when it comes to Yahav, Teitzei Yahav likras Yisrael v'techaseu basmicha. Mahu basmicha? So Reish Lakish wonders, what does the Torah, what does the Navi mean when it says v'techaseu basmicha? So we know that in modern Hebrew, basmicha is a blanket. But Reish Lakish says, chazarnu al kol ha-mikra v'lo matzinu kli sheshmo smicha. This is the first time the word appears. We have to figure out what the word means. Nowhere else in Tanakh, I guess somebody else can check up on Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, nowhere else in Tanakh does this word appear, so what does the word mean? So he quotes some saying that it's a cloak, and some saying that it is some sort of blanket. Reish Lakish says, V'lo matzinu kli sheshmo smicha, mahu smicha, so what is the language of smicha that's used, which is interesting that it's used with in modern Hebrew, it's with a samach, not with a sin, although sometimes the two are interchangeable. He says that it's a way of a God saying, Shmi ko, my name is here. Shmi made aleha, my name is testifying about her, shelo naga bo oso rasha, that this rasha sister never touched her. Okay.
Could you say that again? How does the cloak,
The word that it uses, and again, instead of using a word that we know from anywhere else, that would connote some sort of garment, the techaseu babeged, it could have said, or something like that. It used this new word, smicha, so he says that you read it as shmi ko.
Oh.
It's like a little bit of a play on words, and God is testifying that nothing inappropriate happened. Okay, so this is a very different approach to the story than I think we've ever understood before. But let's pause for a second and try and figure out who was this person, who was Yael. So multiple times we're told, some of them we read, some of them who appeared earlier, that she is the wife, she's Ashes Chever HaKeni, the wife of Chever HaKeni. So who was he? Who was Chever HaKeni? So two important points. The first is that HaKeni was not his last name. HaKeni was telling us where he comes from. He was a Keni. Who were the Keni? The Keni were a nation that's mentioned in the Torah and in the Navi in a few places. The Keni were a nation who lived in Eretz Yisrael. They were one of the other nations who would one day be supplanted by the Jews and in Eretz Yisrael. We do also know from earlier in the Perek, one of the psukim that we skipped, was that the Chever HaKeni was Mibnei Chovav Chosein Moshe, descendants of Chovav, the father-in-law of Moshe, descendants of Yisrael. Okay, and we'll see maybe a little bit later. The Medrash actually draws a very beautiful parallel between Ya'el and Yisro. So the question...
But she's not actually...
Is she Jewish? Jewish. Is Ya'el Jewish? You read the Pesukim, you don't think so?
So we're all naming our children after non-Jewish.
So...
Why did she do this? Does it answer?
What?
Why she did this?
Why she did it? If she's not Jewish?
No, you will.
Yeah. I mean, why is she putting herself on the line?
That's right.
So the question is, was she Jewish? So, okay, I'll be open. I always thought she was Jewish. Okay, this was news. This was news to me. But if she's some sort of great Jewish woman, she was intermarried? It seems not to fit with the rest of the story. She's doing this great, tremendous act. It's possible.
Like Rahab, she wasn't originally Jewish.
Right? No, we do have people. But again, I always thought she was... Just being honest, I always thought she was Jewish. Now, we do know the truth is, we know that Yisro did convert. Yisro was a Jew. What about his children? Because it's an open question. I don't know. Maybe they converted, maybe they didn't convert. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. I'm not sure. But I don't know if his children converted or not. But if you think about it, why else was Sisera going to her tent? He had some sort of peace treaty with a few Jews. In a time of war against the Jews, he's going to escape into the Jewish camp, or very close, maybe. No, so it is clear that he wanted to run away from the battlefield, and a smart place to run was certainly in the direction of the Jews, because Barak would not think to look. That's definitely true. But why would there be peace between a bunch of Jews and Yavin and Sisera? So Rav Yaakov Emden writes explicitly that she wasn't Jewish. She was a great woman. She did a great thing, but she wasn't Jewish. And again, just from the psukim, it's hard to think, why is he wrong? That's certainly the impression you get. So why was she living? Why was she living amongst the Jews? Why was she living next to the Jews? So that we have to go back. The Navi answers that a little bit for us to a pasuk that we skipped. In pasuk Gid Aleph, if we go back a little bit in Perek Dal, pasuk Gid Aleph, a few psukim up in the middle of the page, it says V'chever HaKeni. Nifrod mi Kain. Chever HaKeni separated himself from Kain, from the Keni, from Kain. Mibnei Chovav Chosein Moshe. He was again a descendant of Yisro. Vayet Ohalo, and he planted his tent ad Elon Betzananim, Asher Es Kedesh, again somewhere near the plain of Tzananim, somewhere near Kedesh, near the Jews' camp. Why did he move his tent? Why did he pick up? Why did he separate himself? So I don't know. So some of the first write that he had a fight with the family and he had to separate. Maybe. Again, it seems to be an important point that the Navi is taking because it's important for later in the story. One possibility certainly could be that he separated from the Keni to join the Jews. And maybe at that moment in Pasuk Gid Aleph, they basically left the Keni and they became Jewish. Whether they went through all the technical conversion already or they didn't, I don't know. And then the fact that he's still referred to as Chever HaKeni wouldn't be so difficult, because again, then it would be more of a last name, because that's how he's always been identified. And from Sisera's perspective, maybe he didn't realize how far it went, or maybe he thought that, okay, they separated, but maybe they'll at least be true to the peace that existed beforehand between the Keni and between Yavin Melech Chatzor. So it's a little bit of an open question. However, the impression that you get from Chazal and from Devorah, as we'll soon see, I think, seems to indicate that she was Jewish. Whether it's because she converted at this point, whether she converted beforehand, I don't know. But it's certainly not explicit, which is interesting. And it's left as a little bit of a mystery. Okay, so now that we're thoroughly confused, the story isn't what we thought the story was. Yah wasn't Jewish, we don't know what's going on anymore. So why did we all have a very different understanding of these psukim until a few minutes ago? Okay, so I only told you half the story. The truth is that the story of Yael is recorded again in the Shira of Devorah, in the latter half of the Haftorah. So let's look at those few psukim and see what Devorah was an Aviyah, so whether she knew whatever she was saying b'nevuah, whether it was revealed to her directly by God, or she knew of the events and she happened to be the one who's going to reveal it to us. Let's look at how she describes what happened with Yael. So we turn to page 1154, Pasuk Chaf Dalet.
Did she know Yael?
I don't know. Barak certainly did at the end.
She said it before, though. She said a woman is going to do in Sisera. She says it in Pasuk Tet.
Right. I think that has to do, again, a little bit with a little broader than Haftorah, is whether there's a little bit of a fight between Devorah and Barak, whether Devorah should go along with him to the battle or not. So it might be a little bit broader than that, but right, okay. Yeah, she might have known, or she just knew that it was going to be a woman. Yeah, correct.
But I wanted to ask you later also about the relationship between Barak and Devorah.
That might be a little too broad for us right now, but maybe we'll get to it. Okay, so in Pasuk it says in Pasuk Chav Dalet, Tivorach min Hashem Yael Eishes Chever HaKeni, she should be blessed from women, min Hashem Ba'al Tivorach, blessed amongst or more than, so Machlokas and the Farshim had to understand that Pasuk, than the other women in the tent, again, presumably referring to the Imahos, who were known as the women who were in their tents. So it's very high praise for Yael, interestingly referred to as Eishes Chever HaKeni. She doesn't lose that identity. What happened? Mayim Sha'al, he asked for water, Chalav Nasana, but she gave milk. B'seifa L'adirim, Hikriva Chema, in a beautiful saucer, a saucer of nobility, she brought out butter. Yadal Ayaseh Tishlachna, she sent out her hand to the peg, V'mino L'hamus Amelim, and her right hand to the hammer. So she severed his head, smashed and pierced his temple. Okay, so that, again, so far, all of that is basically everything that the Navi had beforehand. But then there's one more pasuk. Bein ragleha kara nafal shachav, bein ragleha kara nafal basher kara sham nafal shodud. Between her legs he knelt, toppled lay, between her legs he knelt and fell where he knelt. There he fell, vanquished.
Why
did she say that? Well, I don't know. What is she saying? I don't know. I guess it's very poetic, but it just seems to be very, very repetitious. And what exactly is she talking about? It doesn't seem to correlate with anything that we know from the story beforehand. So it seems to be, and this is true, again, it's a little bit broader than we can discuss right now, it seems to be that it's true in the entire Shir of Devorah more than in other songs, which is that Devorah doesn't simply reflect on what happened, but she adds in details. And it happens in a few of the praises that she offers to Hashem. She adds in details of stories that we don't have elsewhere in the Navi. Why that is, I'm not sure. But that, again, that's whatever the style of the Navi was here, and that's the way Hashem presented in the Navi, or that's the way it was written down in the Navi, and then how Devorah chose to present it. So what does this pasuk mean? So Chazal understood this pasuk as follows: there's a Gemara in Nazir and Daf Chaf Gimel Amid Beis. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, Sheva Beilos Baal Osarasha Baosashash and Amar Bein Ragla Karan Afal Shachav. Seven times they had relations between Yael and Sisera at that time. How? Because of this pasuk. It says, they didn't pick up the number seven randomly, but it says languages of falling before her seven different times. Kara, Nafal, Shachav, Kara, Nafal, Kara, Nafal. Seven different times in this pasuk, Devorah uses some sort of language of falling or laying down in front of her. It says Bein Ragla, which seems to be a nice way of saying what happened. And that's what, again, that's, I guess, the story that we're a little bit more familiar with, which is that basically it seems to be that Ya'el seduced her. So realizing, and Rashi fills in the gaps, that the reason that she was doing all this was to exhaust him. And then between that and between the milk, he would fall asleep. And then she would have her opportunity to kill Sisera.
Wait, can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
Who writes the Navi? Who wrote the Navi?
Not me.
Who wrote the Navi? The Navi wrote the Navi.
Well, that's why I'm asking. Wouldn't it have been Devorah?
In each section? I'm not 100% sure.
Because then that would just make this hard to understand that she would write something different in the Perek and then in her Shira.
Well, she didn't write anything. Nothing's different.
Well, that she added. Did she added more details? Why would she write one thing in one place and one thing in another if she wrote both?
So one possibility is that she would rather write it in this poetic way than to write it openly. Again, if the way that Rabbi Yochanan writes it in the Gemara appeared in the Navi, I think we would be a little bit more taken aback than the way that Devorah. Yeah. I don't know.
Sometimes you tell a story and then again, you give details.
Right. According to Reish Lakish, this pasuk has a different meaning. Reish Lakish disagrees with Rabbi Yochanan. Mm-hmm. Right? We had that Reish Lakish was the first Medrash. So again, it seems to be, which was a point that I'm surprised nobody jumped on me at the beginning, but when we mentioned the way Reish Lakish understood the story, he said there were seven people who were basically saved from sinning who didn't sin. According to the basic story, she wasn't saved from sinning. There was no opportunity. What does it have to do with sinning? A man was in her tent. Okay, so a man could come to anybody's house anytime. What does it have to do? How can you compare that to Palti Ben Maya? She was sleeping right next to Michal and had to prevent herself from sinning. How can you compare that to, for years? How can you compare that to Yosef, who had Ashes Potiphar going after him? Okay, so Yael had this general who wanted refuge, who wanted maybe nothing to even do with her. So it seems to be that even Reish Lakish was sensitive to this pasuk, and maybe he viewed it as Bein Ragla, he was attempting to do something with her, and she withstood it, and got him to fall asleep anyway, and drove the peg through his head. So that's the more classic understanding of the way we've understood the story in the past, but it raises obviously some new questions in terms of, was she allowed to do this? We know that there are three sins for which one has to die before and give up his or her life before committing the sins. And one of them is adultery. And she was a married woman. She was married to, we know, Ashes Chaver Hakeni.
She wasn't Jewish.
Ah, so that's a very interesting question. So what's this? So it's still a sin for a non-Jew. It's one of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. She's not allowed to do it. Is there a din of Yehareg Val Yavor when it comes to is a non-Jew required to give up his or her life when threatened to avoid sinning or not?
And does the greater circumstances have anything to do with
this? So that's what we're going to have to, that's going to be the obvious, the factor which is going to play a role here. So in terms of the question of whether it's different for a non-Jew or not, it seems to be, I was having trouble with this yesterday, and I was at a wedding, so I didn't really have any svarim, but I had a few rebbeim, so I was able to at least talk to them about it. So it seems to be that it's actually a machlokas mishonim. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that asks the question, and what the conclusion of the Gemara is, whether a ben Noach is required to give up his life or her life, so as not to violate one of the sheva mitzvot ben Noach, seems to be a machlokas. So I assumed fully until last night, when at least the question came up, I assume that the fact that the Gemara was viewing this as some sort, as we'll see, some sort of sin, and Tosfos starts asking, well, why isn't it Yehareg Val Yavor? And asking questions from Esther, which is obviously very...
Wait, the Gemara views this, what Yael did, as a sin?
Sort of. Okay.
Sorry, you said
it in passing. Okay. So the whole context of the Gemara, but I'm not going to explain everything yet. The Gemara starts off, Amar of Nachman bar Yitzchak, of Nachman bar Yitzchak said, "Gdola avera lishma mi mitzvah shelo lishma." An avera that's done lishma for the sake of heaven is greater than a mitzvah that is done shelo lishma, not for the sake of heaven. How do we know this? We know this from Tivorach Minashim Yael Ishes Chever Akeni Minashim Ba'ol Tivorach Manashim Sheba'ol. Who is she being compared to? Sarifka Rachav Alayah. And we know Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Then Rabbi Yochanan comes in and says Sheva Be'ilos Ba'al Osarasha Bososha. Seven times they were together, like the pasuk says. And so, and she's praised by Devorah. So the fact that she's praised by Devorah for what she did tells us that an Avera, which is Lishma, an Avera which is done for the sake of heaven, is greater than a mitzvah which is done Shelo Lishma. We'll fill in the gaps in terms of, well, so maybe once it's an Avera Lishma, then it shouldn't be an Avera anymore. Maybe it should flip around and turn into a mitzvah. So we'll try and understand that a little bit.
Not even necessarily a mitzvah, but at least a Kiddush Hashem.
So it might have been that. It still might have been a Kiddush Hashem, but...
It's still an Avera.
Right.
Okay.
It's still an Avera. We'll try and understand that a little bit more. We also need to figure out, well, what was her status in terms of her husband afterwards? Was she permitted to go back to her husband afterwards? The halacha is normally that if a woman is raped completely against her will, she's not forbidden to her husband, except a kohen. But any woman who biratzon or even is involved and it's not completely against her will with somebody else when she's married becomes forbidden to her husband. So here certainly.
No, but we're talking about Sisera, who could have put a knife to her throat at any second. So you don't know exactly what the circumstances were. Although he went to her to be saved.
So that's an interesting question. I heard yesterday on the way to this wedding, I heard a shiur where somebody suggested that the story took place in the opposite direction. That Yael was completely passive. Basically, Sisera took advantage of her. She was being very nice and taking good care and giving food and a blanket, and Sisera completely turned on her. I find that hard. First of all, I think his proof was completely wrong for technical reasons. I'm not going to go into it right now. Okay. But I think that that is also wrong because, so why is she so praised? Meaning, if she was completely passive, and all she was basically an object
because
of...
Because she still killed him. She had to go through torture seven times.
She killed him. She killed him to save her life, to save herself. He's been raping her for seven times, and now...
She killed a major person.
Okay, but that puts her on the level of the Imahos. Tevorach Minoshim, like the Gemara says, Sarah Rivka Rachav Aleya, that puts her on that level. So Tosos writes in Ksuvus, I think, he assumes that it can't be. It can't be that she would... Not that it can't be that it wouldn't be an impressive feat on her part and an act of courage, but in terms of the praise which is showered upon her, it just doesn't add up. For somebody who was completely an anusa, and it was completely against her will, and she was basically defending herself, he doesn't think that praise would be greater than... We don't find this praise by Esther.
So her praise is greater if she submitted willingly?
No.
Well, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, because of the context.
Right, I guess.
Exactly, because of...
Yeah, they're in the Shema.
Right, exactly. We're praising the fact that... We don't find such great praise for Esther. So, and that's part of what's bothering Tosos also, is that and no, nobody's doubting what Esther did was appropriate, and it was for the Atzala, it was for the saving all of Klal Yisrael. But we don't find that. And then one other... question which comes up, which maybe we'll just answer in passing, which is that the Gemara in Nazir on Daf Nun Tes, Reb Elazar ben Yaakov says, how do we know that a woman should not go out with weapons like one would go out in a war? So it says that we learned that out from the pasuk of Lo Yekli Gever Alisha V'Lo Yibash Gever Simlas Isha, that a man shouldn't wear what a woman wears and a woman shouldn't wear what a man wears. And it's assumed, again, there are tshuvos from modern poskim. Right? Przanski quotes some in his book. He has a piece on Yahu, which is very interesting. We'll get to one of the points that he makes a little bit later in terms of the modern-day fighting and war. But again, the Gemara at least assumes that a woman should not be using weapons. And Rashi explains there that we learn it out from Yael, Eishes Chever Akeni, that she could have used a sword. She didn't use a sword. She used a peg because she didn't want... So it seems a little bit strange. She's willing to do an awful lot of other, what we call bigger sins, in order to undo Sisera. But I'm not going to go that much. I'm not going to do. I'm not going to use a sword. Seems to be again. It seems to be a little bit strange.
And yet we still don't think she's Jewish. So is this?
Oh no! Again, I think again the impression that you have again, according to some Rishonim, it has to be that she's Jewish because otherwise she would not have been required to give up to give up her life, and then the whole Avir Lishma topic doesn't seem to be a question at all. So I think, again, according to at least, I think that the general assumption, I don't think, is so far off. So those who have children named Yael don't have to... No, either way, she's obviously praised by Devorah. You can have great non-Jewish women also. She certainly was
her
praised.
Her name wouldn't have gone for posterity if she wasn't a great person.
It says Devorah, Devorah solidifies...
The Gemara doesn't think so.
The Gemara does think so. It says what she did was great. God love Erlish. What she did is better than somebody who does a mitzvah shalolish. We're just trying to put it in now. Again, the Gemara seems to be treating it from a halacha context. We're trying to understand that a little bit. So the question is, was Yael allowed to do this? So this idea of seducing the enemy apparently is known as a honey trap. It's been used by spy agencies and... And so the Mefarshim deal with the question of how she could violate the Aveira instead of giving up her life. I stumbled upon recently, it was in the headlines, I think I even mentioned it when we were doing Yehudas, but I haven't seen it yet. There's an article in Tchumen, a recent periodical, where it discusses this exact question of, is the Mossad in Israel allowed to use women in such a way as spies in order to... Right. Save in order to save Klal Yisrael. The article does point out that it's purely theoretical because the women that the Mossad is using are probably not asking a question like this. But it's important to know for the future of a state that will hopefully be run according to the Torah. What's the Torah's perspective? Sorry,
you have the story of Hannah Senish, who was trapped behind the lines in World War II.
Right, that was right. Przanski brings down an example of a Russian nuclear scientist in 1986, where apparently the Mossad did this. I forgot the name. Check in his book. But again, he admits that it's not a very practical question, but it's still important. So again, the two examples that we need to work with is Yael and Esther. Those seem to be the two cases where we have, I guess, somewhat willing participants, not fully willing, especially when it came to Esther. The Gemara assumes that it was all against her will. It was all against her will until the last time, Chasher Avadati, and we assume that she was married to Mordechai. But, and which is a little bit harder to compare to the case of Sisera. So again, so one heter that the Gemara keeps using when it refers to Esther, the Gemara always says, Esther Karka Olam. She made herself like the ground, she was completely passive. Again, that does work in some cases, and some try to apply that to Yael. It's a little bit more difficult to assume that if she's actively trying to seduce Sisera, that she's completely passive, but okay, it is what it is. But the Meiri and others explain that normally the rule is, Yehareg v'al-Yavor, when it comes to these things, you have to be killed before violating the sin, but that's in the context of saving an individual. What Esther and Yael did was to save Klal Yisrael, and to save the Jewish people, the rules are different. And maybe there are even no exact rules, and whatever is necessary can be done. The Shus Yaakov and Achuva deals with a case of, it was a group that was traveling and was captured by a bunch of bandits, and they were all going to be killed for their money. And with her husband's permission, one of the women who was very attractive was able to seduce the person in charge and was able to save them all. And now they asked, what's her status in terms of her husband? Is she allowed to be with her husband afterwards? Or is she, again, she willingly did it. He willingly had her do it, agreed that she should go ahead and do it. Is she forbidden to her husband or not? So it seems to be a machlokas, and the issues that they deal with are whether we can even compare it to Yael or not. And when it comes to Yael, there is a machlokas amongst the Mefarshim whether she was permitted to her husband afterwards or not. The Rav Shlomo Kluger writes, the Meiri seems to say this, I'm sorry, the Kliyakar seems to say this also, that she was permitted to her husband afterwards. And that's why she's constantly referred to as Eishes Chaver Akeni. Even after it takes place, she's still referred to as Eishes Chaver because she's still the wife of Chaver. But many others disagree. And I think what they would explain, I'm not 100% sure, but I think the way they would explain why she's still called Eishes Chaver Akeni, why do we identify her as the wife of Chaver Akeni again multiple times, even after she's forbidden to live with him afterwards. So maybe it's based on a medrash, which maybe would imply that he too was in agreement, And maybe that's what it's trying to reflect. The Medrash says, Mativa shel Yaal shebasa tshuva gedola al yada. What did Yaal do? What great merit did she have that she was the one who was able to facilitate saving Klal Yisrael? Amru isha kshera haisa. She was a correct, a proper woman. Ve'oseh ritzon baila. And she used to do the will of her husband. That a proper woman is one who listens to her husband. Everybody heard? That's what the Medrash says. It wasn't me. But what does the Medrash mean? I think what the Medrash means, what the Medrash is trying to give him credit for what she did it. What's the Medrash, what credit are we trying to give to him? What does it have to do with the fact that she used to do the will of her husband? So I think maybe what the Medrash is trying to say is that she realized that she was going to become forbidden if she would go through with this act with Sisera. And she was willing to do it. And she was willing to do it anyway and make that sacrifice of giving up her life with her husband. But maybe it's inconsiderate. Because at the same time, her husband is losing his wife. So that's what the Medrash is saying. The Medrash is highlighting that she is somebody who knew the Ritzon Baila, somebody who was in tune, completely in sync with her husband, and therefore she understood that he would be completely in agreement as well. So again, the credit is due to her. But at least he gets the honorable mention of she's considered to always be Eshes Chever HaKeni. It recognizes her throughout as his wife, not because she's permitted afterwards, but because she's forbidden afterwards, and in terms of being in agreement with her plan, it was her plan, but in terms of being in agreement, they were completely in sync, and she understood, because she knew her husband so well and understood the ratzon of her husband, that her husband would be completely in agreement. The rest of the article is a little bit more technical, just to highlight the conclusions, because they're a little bit interesting, is that the conclusion seems to be that such, quote-unquote, honey traps, as Makodes Dvash, as he refers to them, are in fact allowed, according to the Torah, as we see from these stories. Although he points out, and it seems to be logical, that given the choice, it would be better to use a single woman as opposed to a married woman, because it's not clear, again, it seems to be this is a machlokas, whether in fact she would become forbidden to her husband or not afterwards. Alternatively, he says if the husband is not a Kohen, he could divorce her right before the mission and remarry her after the mission. Okay. Interesting. It has to do. I'm sorry. Right, that option does not work if she's the wife, if the husband's correct. If it's a non-Kohen, then we have at least the second option of using perhaps a married woman. Okay, what's this idea? What's the idea of Avera Lishma? So the way it sounds is if it's a technical prohibition, but given the circumstances, it was the right way to proceed. It does not mean that every Avera for a good purpose, if I'm doing something wrong but I have good intentions, in the end justify the means, and as long as what I'm doing is for a good reason, that it's okay. And in fact, that we have a special pasuk for. We didn't have a limit for, right, in Echnami. It's exactly the point, is that for Avera Lishma doesn't say that there are no lines. We have exceptions, such as lying for Shalom Bayis. Or other such exceptions, whenever they come up, we have times where we do have leeway. But it does not mean that every Avera for a good purpose. Okay, and I think the only two times the Gemara even uses the phrase of Avera Lishma is when it comes to Esther and when it comes to Yaal. I don't think in any other context. Rabbi Pruzansky has a very interesting explanation of the statement that the Gemara makes. Because the Gemara juxtaposes and saying that an Avera Lishma is greater than a mitzvah shelo Lishma. And what he points out is that each one reflects an action which has the abnormal motivation. Meaning mitzvos are something which is normally motivated by your yitzer tov. When you're doing it shelo lishma, then the motivation for your mitzvah, which is technically good, the motivation is coming from the yitzer hara. It's coming from some ulterior motive. When it comes to an avera lishma, it's the opposite. Normally an avera is something which is driven by your yitzer hara. But the lishma, in this case, the technical prohibition is there, but the motivation is completely from the Yetzer Tov. And in that sense, the Gemara seems to be hiding that again, on a certain level, when the context was correct, that it's Rachmana Liva Boy, that God wants our intentions, and God wants it to be completely pure. Now, how do I know not to apply it broadly? Maybe Yael and Esther are the model, and we can apply a Ve'er L'Shema whenever we feel it's necessary. So that's the end of the Gemara. The Gemara asks, right after it explains what happened after Rabbi Yochanan's statement, it says, the Gemara asks the question, but she got pleasure. The Gemara answers, the Gemara says, no, that when it's coming from a Rasha, and the person was a Tzaddik, so there's no Hana at all. But what was the Gemara's question? And who cares? So maybe she did enjoy herself. What does it matter? She's still doing an Aveir Lishma. So what's clear is that the Gemara assumes that as good as her intention might have been, if there was even a minor, a minuscule amount of benefit for her, then it would lose the status of Aveir Lishma. That when it comes to, again, breaking the mold and allowing an Aveir Lishma, it's not just a general good intention. It has to be 100, 1000% completely Lishma. So that, again, that's how I know not to apply it, more broadly. Running out of time. Okay, I gotta get back to the connection to the Parsha. Quickly, what's the praise comparing it to the Imahos? So I think what that, again, whether it means more than the Imahos, the same as the Imahos, I think perhaps the idea of something that we've mentioned in past when similar types of topics have come up, which is that, again, the Imahos are the model of other people who were in their Ohel, and they were the model of women for the future of Klal Yisrael. So they're gonna look down at this act, and on the surface, what you're seeing that Yah is doing is something which they're going to push aside. It's something completely inappropriate for a Jewish woman. So what Devorah is praising is that no, in the context, the way she acted was appropriate. And that's maybe what Chazal are highlighting with that strange medrash before, the strange statement of Chazal, that she, as much as she was doing and she was involved in this sexual relationship with Sisera, she wouldn't use a sword. Whatever wasn't necessary, whatever would go beyond what was absolutely necessary for the situation, that she wasn't going to do. She wasn't going to compromise herself. She knew exactly what the boundary was. She knew she had to deal with Sisera. She knew she had to give herself up. Maybe she even had to give up her future relationship with her husband. That she was willing to do. And what Devorah is telling us is that that's on the same level of the Imahos, because she understood that in this context, that's why, again, it seems to be a technical violation of Tznius, but in this context, it was the appropriate thing to do. And maybe, again, if you smug the first that her praise is Minoshim, it's even greater than the Imahos, that they never had a challenge such as this. They never had to sink, you know, lower themselves for the sake of bringing up Klal Yisrael. And in a certain sense, she's on even a higher level than, again, it's hard to compare, you know, levels when it comes to these things. But in terms of this aspect of being a woman of the Ohel, maybe because she was challenged and was able to meet that challenge, she's on even a greater level. So what's the connection, again, now that we spent so much time learning this story, which I think is a focal part of the Haftorah, so what's the connection to the Parsha? So I think maybe, again, the obvious connection I think is still there. I'm not saying we should delete the half that deals with the Shira. I think that's certainly there. But there are other Shiros, there are other songs that appear in Tanakh that we could have chosen as the Haftorah. The reason that we chose this one and that we appended to it and before it, we have this story of Yael, I think is because this Parsha of B'Shalach is really B'nai Yisrael's first time traveling as a nation anywhere. The first time they've now left Egypt, they're traveling as a nation. And coming along with that is ups and downs. And they're going to have positives, they're going to have negatives, they're going to have Amalek attacking, they're going to have trouble having food, they're going to have different events that take place. But our parsha is filled with God intervening on their behalf in miraculous ways. We have Kriyas Yamsuf, we have the sweetening of the water in Mara, we have the Mun, we have the Slav, the quails, and it culminates with the war against Amalek. And in the war against Amalek, they're losing the war. Moshe puts his hands up in the air, and as long as they're looking up to Moshe's hands, and Moshe's hands are there, they're winning. So Gemara Mishnah says the obvious. You think Moshe's hands are making or breaking? Well, no. It's Kol Zman. As long as Bnei Yisrael are looking to Shemayim, then everything's going to be okay. Then they can win the war. When they're not looking towards heaven, as strong as their army may be, it's not going to happen. So what's Hashem trying to teach us? Why all these open miracles as we're beginning our existence as a nation? So I think it's to teach Bnei Yisrael at the very beginning that everything comes from Him. And it's not always going to be that everything is an open miracle. It's not going to be that you're always going to get food directly from me. but you should realize that right now I'm providing for you, and that should serve as a lesson in the future that you should realize that when there are these nisim nistarim, when you're getting your food in hidden ways, and it seems to just be the natural order of the world, that's also coming from me. It's supposed to remind Bnei Yisrael that in everything they're doing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is intervening and God is running, and God is running the world, and your faith should be strong. And I think that's really what the story of Yael and Sisera highlights as well. This mighty general is fighting against Bnei Yisrael. How are Bnei Yisrael going to prevail? How are they going to win in the war? And the answer is, on their own, they can't. When Moshe's hands were down, when they're not looking towards Shemayim, it's not going to happen. How could a lone woman take down this great general? Who would have thought that it's possible? But alone she can't either. But what she understood was that if she's acting with this Avera Lishma, if she's acting solely for the sake of heaven, if she realizes that this is my opportunity, if God gave me this chance, I need to take the chance, and I need to put my own life on the line in order to save Kal Yisrael, whether it's because she was a Jew, whether it's because she realized that this is the nation that God is looking out for, even if she's as a Gentile or as a convert. I'm not acting alone. God is the one who's given me the chance, and He's the one who's running the world. And it's with that confidence that she was able to proceed, and she was able to act in this courageous way. So besides the Shira, the Parsha and the Haftorah, I think, are linked in reminding us that our success as a nation doesn't come from us. It's not from Moshe's hands. At the end of the Torah, it's not from Moshe's hands. We're not going to beat Amalek like that. And that's what Amalek fights against. Amalek tries to show everything is Mikra. Everything is happenstance. God isn't intervening. And what God is showing with the hands of Moshe being up is that it's the opposite. The only way to win things, even when it seems to be in the natural order, is by looking towards heaven. And that's the same lesson, I think, that the Imahos and that Yael, like the Imahos, reminds us of, is that in everything that we do, whether it's revealed or not revealed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who is watching over.